Oyez, 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 the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Welcome, good afternoon, you may be seated. My name is Gisella Triana, I'm the Senior Judge of the Third Court of Appeals, and I'd like to, along with Justice Lopez Theofanis and Justice Crump, welcome you to the Third Court of Appeals. At this time, I am going to go ahead, well, let's do a couple of housekeeping with my lawyers. Are y'all breaking up at 15 minutes? Are we? Okay, so we've got these little lights right here. Green is go, yellow is be cautious, you've got 2 minutes left, and red is stop. Obviously, if you're in the middle of, you know, a thought or something, feel free to finish. I'm not going to make you stop. But be aware that your time is up. We have divided the time, so 15 for the defendant. It'll be 20 for the state, and then you'll have your rebuttal of 5 minutes, and we'll have those lights. Also, we are on YouTube. We have this will be live broadcasted on our YouTube channel. It's also being recorded, so if you want to go back and see how you did, or if my students are so thrilled, want to go look at the oral arguments afterwards, it'll be there at some point, probably later today or tomorrow, and you can do that as well. At this time, I am going to call cause number 0323-742-CR, Mark Jason Norman versus the State of Texas, and is Mr. Norman ready to proceed?
Yes, ma'am.
And is the state ready to proceed?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, if I can have y'all make your announcements for the record by telling me your name, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
My name is Bill Troy, and I'm here for the appellant, Mark Norman.
Holly Weatherford for the state.
Thank you. Mr. Troy, if you're ready to proceed, you can approach the bench. I mean, not the bench. You can approach the podium.
May it please the court.
And before you start, is there a way that maybe we can get some air conditioning in here? It's a little hot. Thank you. You may proceed, Mr. Troy.
May it please the court, counsel, good afternoon, justices. Boiled down to its core, this case is about whether the state met its burden in the suppression hearing in this matter. And I think in order to analyze that, the threshold issue that has to be discussed is what standard of review the court should employ. And there's been a lot of cases about that. At first glance, sometimes the rulings seem to be contradictory, but there is a common theme throughout all of the case law. And that is, if the findings of fact that are found by the court are not supported by the record, the court has the ability and sometimes the obligation to go back and take a look at the record de novo and do a de novo review of the facts. And I think the starting point is the seminal case, Guzman, out of the Court of Criminal Appeals in 1997. And Guzman stands for the proposition that if fact-finding is supported by the record, and especially if the fact-finding is based on credibility and demeanor determinations, the appellate court should give deference. But it also states that if the fact-finding is not supported by the record, the Court of Appeals has the ability to do a de novo review. It discusses whether the trial court is in a better position than the appellate courts in looking at the record and deciding the facts, deciding the issues. And of course, that's the case when there are credibility issues, which basically means when there are witnesses, which there are at the vast majority of suppression hearings. The state seems to agree with that, and in page 9 of their brief, they said Guzman's deferential standard does not require a reviewing court to ignore admitted evidence, such as a videotape, when such evidence does not support the lower court's fact-finding. And then a couple other cases along this line, one that was cited by both the state and the defense in their briefs is Carmucci out of the Court of Criminal Appeals in 2000. And these cases seem to say that even when there are credibility determinations, the court can still go back and look at the record de novo if the record does not support the trial court's findings of facts. The Court of Criminal Appeals in that case said the video belied the officer's testimony. They did their de novo review. They said we can't blind ourselves to video evidence. And then they overturned the court's ruling as to whether there was consent to search the appellant's person. And then the next case, also out of the Court of Criminal Appeals in 2012, Miller, I believe, coherently summarizes all the prior case law along this line. And the issue in that case is whether officers had consent or probable cause to remain in an apartment. There was testimony on the issue at the suppression hearing. The trial court denied the motion to suppress with findings of fact. The appellate court used great deference and upheld the ruling of the trial court. And then the Court of Criminal Appeals got a hold of it, and they looked at the videos and they said, wait a second, the videos don't support what the trial court's findings were. They don't support what the decision was. And they said deference is due only if the trial court's rulings are supported by the record. And they also said, in order to determine whether the evidence supports the trial court's findings, the Court of Appeals must take all of the evidence, including the video, into account. And so what that means to me is the trial court is almost obligated to go back and take a look at the record to see if the record does support the findings, particularly if the findings are contested. And then if the record doesn't support the findings, then the appellate court has the ability, or in some cases the obligation, to do a de novo review of the facts. And that's what...
And Mr. Troy, what findings of facts are y'all disputing? Are y'all saying that the record actually contradicts? Not necessarily. I mean, I understand the argument of you've got an officer that says, you know, they had probable cause to search your client. You have an officer that says they only have probable cause, you know, to search the passenger. So I understand the discrepancy. But other than that, what do you claim the video or the record shows would go against, and which specific finding?
And I am prepared to talk about a few examples of that in addition to what I have in my brief. The trial court on page 23 of the findings of fact said the protective pat down uncovered the large vial full of meth, which could have appeared to be a weapon before the officers removed and observed it. And then the trial court goes on and says that gave them probable cause to continue the search and to find the heroin for which my client was eventually convicted. That is not what the record showed. That's not what the video showed. That's certainly not what the state proved. There's zero evidence that the pat down, there was a brief 30-second frisk or pat down. There's zero evidence that that uncovered anything. There's zero discussion in any of the police reports, which are also part of the record, of a frisk even being done. And on the video, it was the probationary officer, Cool, who did the frisk. He makes no mention of feeling anything suspicious, which gives them additional justification to search, of feeling a weapon, of feeling anything like that, that would allow them to continue with a full-on probable cause search. And so that's one of the areas where the findings are not supported by the record. Another area is the trial court said that my client had a rapid speech, that he was stuttering, that he was nervous, and then he quoted Officer Meyer, who said much after the drugs were found that my client was speaking like a meth head. And so the trial court found consciousness of guilt evidence, and because he was nervous, that's a factor, of course, that can go into a probable cause analysis. But if we look at what they knew before the seizure occurred, and the seizure occurred when he first stepped out of the vehicle and he was told that we're going to do a search of your person. And at that point, I believe it was Officer Meyer said, your demeanor is kind of changing a little bit. And that's when the nervousness kicked in. Before that, all we heard was that he's sober, he's fine, he's not intoxicated. All of these words were used prior to my client stepping out of the vehicle. And so I think finding that he has rapid speech, that he's stuttering, that he's nervous as a part of the probable cause analysis is not supported by the record, because that came after the seizure. That came after the moment where we do our analysis. Another example is the trial court said that my client was not warned for his driving without a license infraction. And I don't believe the record upholds that. And again, I don't believe that the state proved that. What we have on record, which is just the police reports and the video, because there was no witness testimony, is Sergeant Meyer saying, we're just gonna give you a warning. I'm not going to hit you with a ticket. You've got bills to pay. And this is all in the context of my client having expressed twice that he was concerned about his license status going forward. And so what the trial court is finding that is that even though all of these things were said, what the officer who said it meant was that he was going to warn him for the failure to stop infraction, but he was going to arrest him for the driving without a license infraction. And I think that that defies common sense. And I certainly don't think that the state met their burden of proof in that.
But let me ask you, Mr. Troy, isn't it an objective test that we look at if you're going to be arresting some, or if you're doing a search incident to an arrest? Isn't it an objective standard that we're not looking at what a police officer was thinking at the time as to, okay, am I going to arrest him or am I not going to arrest him for driving without a valid driver's license?
Yes, ma'am, of course. But I do think that what Sergeant Meyer, the ranking officer and the initial stopping officer, thought as a subjective officer is relevant to the objective officer analysis. And moreover, we have case law. I think it's Williams, Linnett, and there's one other one that's cited in my brief that says that once an officer says he's going to give you a ticket, not even just a warning, but a ticket, that they then lose the ability to search incident to arrest, that that's not the type of custodial detention that justifies a search incident to arrest. And so I think for the search incident to arrest, once it's said on the record that he's going to receive a warning, then I think the state's burden certainly then kicks in, and the state needs to get up and say, what was he issued for a warning for? There should be testimony, and the officer's credibility should be assessed as to whether the officer meant he was only going to give a warning for one infraction and arrest for another infraction. I think here the record, the state still has the burden, and I don't think the state met that burden that he wasn't going to be issued a warning for this other violation.
And so is your proposition that if the officer, if we knew without a doubt that the officer was doing the search for probable cause, not for a search incident to arrest, that they cannot, you know, objectively, even though they had the right to arrest him, they would not be able to claim that it was incident to the arrest?
I guess I'm not sure that I followed the question, Your Honor.
Let's assume that we believe that the search was under probable cause. Let's assume that the officers were clear. We're going to search you. The reason we're doing a search is based on probable cause. Is it your belief, or are you arguing, even though there was an incident? And let's assume there's, you know, I understand you're arguing that they specifically, you believe there were not going to, I'm only going to give you a warning meant as to both the failure to stop at the white line and, as well as the driving without a valid license. Are you saying that under those circumstances, even though the officer had a right to arrest your client, if they had chosen to do it just a, you know, not arrest him at that time, do a probable cause search, that they cannot, objectively, we cannot look at and say, well, he could have arrested him, and therefore, this is incident to
arrest. I think the case law is clear that once they have probable cause, if they did have probable cause that he was in possession of drugs, then of course they can search him. As soon as you have probable cause, you can
search. Let's assume they didn't have probable cause.
And that is our argument,
right?
Certainly, that they didn't have probable cause. If they don't have probable cause, then you can search incident to arrest because they did have probable cause for driving without a license. And if they wouldn't have said, hey, we're going to give you a ticket, then of course they can search him. We have no grounds to deny that. But the second that the officer says, we're going to give you a warning or we're going to write you a ticket, the case law is also pretty clear that once they do that, they are no longer allowed to search incident to arrest.
Okay. Can you tell me which cases that you believe support the proposition that the search couldn't have been supported on either ground?
On probable cause or
incident to
arrest. And so probable cause, I think the primary case is DeRay, which we cited in our brief, which says You can't search just because you have probable cause on a passenger in a vehicle or an occupant of a vehicle, I believe they say, or because you have probable cause on a vehicle doesn't mean you have probable cause for all occupants of the vehicle. There's case law that says that probable cause is, and let me find that site. Probable cause has to be particularized to the person who you are searching. And that's Ford v. State, which is, there's two Ford v. States in our briefs. This is the one from 2017. Probable cause is a reasonable ground for belief of guilt that is particularized with respect to the person to be searched or seized. And then another case that just the state cited is the Parker case, and it says under Texas law, an officer must have probable cause with respect to the person being arrested. Probable cause for a person must point like a beacon towards the specific person. And so it's clear that they had probable cause to arrest the passenger. She made all of these admissions, but one very important thing that distinguishes it from almost all of the cases that the state cited is that the passenger took full responsibility for any paraphernalia in the vehicle. She said, it's all mine. He doesn't use drugs. He knows that I used to use drugs, but he doesn't know that I currently use drugs. He was just giving me a ride home. There's nothing that I have in there. I don't want anything to get him in trouble. The officer asked that specifically, and she said, I do have something in my purse, and I may well have something in my bags that I put in the back, but he doesn't have anything. And one thing that D. Ray says as to why the probable cause was no good to search the appellant in that case was that a confidential informant had singled out, it was either the driver or the passenger, I forget, and not the appellant. And they said, the officers in this situation have an informant that have said, this is the guilty person, and then they go and do a probable cause search of this other person. Here in our case, what we have is a person singling herself out, making an admission against her own interest, which I think probably should carry even more weight than something a confidential informant with all the credibility issues that a confidential informant has singling another person out.
And to follow up, what are the cases as to the incident search incident to arrest? I think you said Williams, Lynette.
And I will give you the other case. And Thomas is the other case, all three of which I believe are cited in my original brief. And what those cases, William says that once a ticket has, this is the first footnote in Williams, once an officer has said, I'm going to issue a ticket, that they can no longer, oh, and I see I'm blinking red, I wasn't paying attention to that.
That's okay, I'll let you finish.
Once the officer says he's going to issue a ticket, that's not the type of custodial arrest that's envisioned for a search. And they're differentiating the other two cases, Lennett and Thomas, and both Lennett and Thomas had the situation where a ticket was being issued, and so the appellate court found that there was not probable cause, or there wasn't justification for search incident to arrest because that was the type of detention it was.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Weatherford?
May it please the court, counsel. I just want to mention from the outset, appellant mentioned the standard of review, and it's the state's position that this court should review the case in the light most favorable to the trial court's ruling, including the express and implied findings of the trial court. The appellant in this case didn't object or request any additional findings after the trial court filed its findings, and just wanted to mention that. Furthermore, the trial court in this case did have authority to review the evidence that the state presented at the suppression hearing, both the reports from the officers and the video. And the trial court was also justified under several theories mentioned in the state's brief to find probable cause in this case, and that was search incident to arrest under the totality of the circumstances and as a protective pat down as well. I'm sorry. Did you have a question?
No, go ahead.
Oh, okay. As far as the search incident to arrest, it was a proper search incident to arrest in this case because the officer, of course, observed him committing a traffic offense, so he had reasonable suspicion to pull him over. The appellant admitted to having no driver's license, and that's an arrestable offense. So right at that point, the officers had probable cause to arrest the appellant. The officers performed their search, and they formally arrested the appellant just a few minutes following the search. And so the officers, as you were mentioning, the subjective motivations that the officer has for arresting don't come into play when you're talking about search incident to arrest. So he had probable cause to do this as a search incident to arrest. There was probable cause to arrest before the search, and the search was done close in time to the search as well.
Can I ask you a question related to that?
Sure.
Isn't the weapons frisk supposed to be fairly limited? And are there any cases that would suggest that they could or should be used to justify search and seizure?
As far as the protective pat down, the officer did do a limited search, but there is case law that if you do feel something that could be a weapon, then they can get into the pocket. And that's what happened here. The probationary officer is doing the pat down, and the trial court actually made a finding that it was reasonable for the officer to believe, based on the very large bulge that the appellant had, that there could be some sort of weapon in there. If you go back and look at the video, the appellant had a very large number of items in his pocket. So when you look at that, it is reasonable for the officer to believe that he would have had a weapon in his pocket.
But we don't have anywhere in the record that an officer thought that it might be a weapon, correct?
As far as a statement from the officer, no, Your Honor.
Okay.
But like you said, it is an objective standard when we go back and look at the facts and look at the video. The officers also had probable cause to search him under a totality of the circumstances. As mentioned in our brief, under the automobile exception, a warrantless search is permitted of a vehicle if it's readily mobile and there's probable cause to believe that the vehicle contains contraband, which here the officer did. There's a multitude of facts that were listed out in the trial court's findings that showed that the officer did have probable cause to search appellant. And while you don't have to have particularized suspicion on the defendant, we did in this case. There was a 911 call that came in that there was an intoxicated female slamming bottles of liquor at the Twin Liquors, and the officer responded, and when he got there, he noticed that their vehicle was parked skewed. He followed them. Noticing that the officer was there, they took off real fast, and the officer observed him fail to stop at the white stop line. When he approached them, he confirmed that the passenger inside the vehicle was the same woman that was at the Twin Liquors. Both of them were sweating profusely despite the air conditioner. And like appellant said, the officer noted that appellant right at that moment when he approached was speaking really quickly, and he described it like a meth head. Appellant admitted that he had no driver's license, and the officer observed a needle in the passenger's purse. She admitted to being a heroin user.
Well, let me talk about that just
sure.
a little bit, if you don't mind pausing there. Mm-hmm. With regard to the contraband found on the passenger, are there any cases that would help us to understand whether or not that should be considered in terms of the search of the driver? Contraband found on the passenger, could that be used to support the search and seizure of the driver?
Right, well, we're looking at a totality of the circumstances here, so it's a factor to be considered. If we're talking about the case that appellant is talking about, we're not saying that just because she had a needle in her purse that that's an automatic search of the driver. We're saying, if the Supreme Court in Wyoming v. Houghton said, if you have probable cause to search a vehicle, you can search the vehicle and all containers within the vehicle. So appellant's pocket would be a container that's within the vehicle. There's other cases, there's Court of Criminal Appeals case that says the odor of marijuana would allow for probable cause to search a vehicle. And courts of appeals have also found that the odor of marijuana could, if there's an odor of marijuana, you can search all occupants in the vehicle. So all of the facts that I've been going through here, that totality of the circumstances gave probable cause to search appellant in this case.
But unlike the odor of marijuana, which could mean or indicate that either of the individuals in the vehicle were using the marijuana while the car was moving, unlike that situation, you've got someone whose contraband is contained within the purse. And so my question was kind of specific to, are you aware of any case that would support contraband found on the person of a passenger being used to support, even in the totality of the circumstances, whether that can be used to support the search and seizure of the driver?
Right, but there was also other observations that the officer made as far as the vehicle. I mean, he observed that there was a torch lighter in there. Also, just because the passenger said, you know, well, they're all mine or this is mine, doesn't mean that she could be lying. She also said that there was going to be more contraband in the vehicle. And so the officer didn't need to believe the passenger that the rest of the contraband that was in the vehicle that she admitted to was going to be all hers.
No cases, though, out there that support that proposition, that narrow proposition.
Will you repeat the question again?
Just whether or not there are any cases that indicate that the court should rely on the existence of contraband on a passenger in support of search and seizure of a driver's person.
There, the Maryland v. Pringle, also from the Supreme Court, found that if you have probable cause to arrest, that there can be probable cause to arrest all the passengers in a vehicle if there's contraband within the vehicle. So that would be something similar to, for example, the passenger in this case having contraband. However, in our case, we also did have an admission that there would be more contraband in the vehicle.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And other than the contraband in his pocket, was there contraband in the vehicle? I know there was paraphernalia.
There was paraphernalia, yes.
Okay.
She admitted that there would be more paraphernalia.
Okay.
In the vehicle, the contraband was found in his pockets. Okay. Going back to the protective pat down. The officers were justified in believing that the appellant was armed and dangerous here, and that allowed them to perform a protective pat-down in this case as well. And again, the test is objective. So again, the reasonableness for the stop is not in question, and the officer had authority to ask appellant to exit the vehicle. It was a nighttime roadside stop involving drugs, and the Supreme Court has consistently recognized that investigative detentions in vehicles are especially fraught with danger. So when the officer asked appellant to get out of the vehicle, he, again, as I mentioned earlier, immediately noticed that large bulge. When the officer asked him what was in it, I think the officer described it as he immediately took a bladed stance, trying to hide the pocket from the officer. He was trying to stick his hands in the pocket. Officer had to remove it. So considering all of that, it was reasonable for the officer to believe that appellant had or was concealing a weapon. And again, when the probationary officer was performing the pat down, there was a reasonable inference that the appellant's pocket contained a weapon, considering the amount of items that he had in there. And the trial court did make a finding that prior to removing the clear vial with methamphetamine, that the officer could have believed that it was a weapon.
Counsel, could you address your friend on the other side's argument about what standard of review that we should be applying here?
So in reviewing a motion to suppress, of course, appellate courts apply the bifurcated standard of review, and the appellate court gives almost total deference to the trial court's findings, and the mixed questions of law to fact that don't rely on credibility are reviewed de novo. And it's our position that this court should review the case in the light most favorable to the trial court's finding in this case. I think when appellant is mentioning several of the facts and the facts that he contests in this case, he's looking at them in the light most favorable to the defendant or to the appellant. And after the trial court filed its findings of fact and conclusions of law, the appellant didn't object to those findings, and he didn't request any additional findings under Rule of Civil Procedure 298. So I think it was this court in Powell v. State. It's an unpublished case, but this court held that where a trial court makes no specific findings regarding no specific findings regarding the length of a delay of a traffic stop, but the court said that a reviewing court can assume that the trial court made any implied findings that are necessary to support the ultimate ruling, as long as they're supported by the record. And if we have an officer's report and we have a video, the trial court's findings in this case, if we go back and look at the video, are all supported by the video. This court in that Powell case, and the citation is 2011 Text App Lexis 7601, it cited to a Court of Criminal Appeals case of Altiera, where the Court of Criminal Appeals stated that despite the lack of an explicit factual finding on a contested fact issue, a reviewing court still must view the totality of the facts in the light most favorable to the trial court's ruling. So when we're looking at the facts of this case, we're looking at them in the light most favorable to the trial court's ruling.
But is the standard, do you agree the standard of review is de novo or abuse of discretion? Or, I mean, when you say that it's bifurcated, mm-hmm. What do you mean?
Well, in this case, we're looking at it in the light most favorable to the trial court's ruling. I know appellant mentioned the fact that there's a video. However, there's not, I think the video can be reviewed de novo when the facts don't support what's in the video. If we look at the video, I think the facts are, all the findings of facts made by the trial court are supported by the video.
Okay. But if we did not, then we would review de novo. You agree with that suggestion?
Did not what? I'm sorry.
If we review the video and determine that it is objectively inaccurate, the finding by the court, then we would review de novo, correct?
Correct. Even if this case were reviewed de novo, there's still more than enough to show probable cause under any of the theories that the the trial court made findings on in this case.
Will you help us, and perhaps it's better a question asked for Mr. Troy, but direct us to which finding relates specifically to what has been alleged by the appellant to be objectively incorrect finding related to the stop. Do you know which finding that was?
I'm sorry, will you repeat that, please? I have the findings here.
I'll wait till Mr. Choi comes back, because I think okay. He's got a few minutes. I just wanted him to direct the court to which finding specifically he's challenging on appeal.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Well, if there aren't any further questions, I'll just mention that the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness. And when you do look at everything, as we've been talking about, in the light most favorable to the trial court's ruling, and you consider the combined and cumulative force of the evidence and the information known to the officers, as well as reasonable inferences from that evidence and information, the trial court had more than what is necessary to constitute probable cause in this case. And so the state would respectfully ask that you affirm the trial court's judgment in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Weatherford.
Mr. Troy, I guess you know what question I'm going to ask you.
I will start there.
Give you a little heads up.
And so it's finding number 36, but the particular part is at the bottom of page 23.
Thank you.
And it says, provided officers with an objectively reasonable basis to conduct a protective pat-down of defendant's person, and when the protective pat-down uncovered a large vial full of meth, which could have appeared to be a weapon.
Okay.
That's the particular part. And the state just indicated that if they feel something, then they can continue the search, and that should be under an objective standard. I don't see how that's the case. There is Young v. State, which says when an officer does a pat-down and then feels a pill bottle, that a pill bottle is not obviously enough. It's not obviously contraband. It's not obviously a weapon. And so that doesn't justify them continuing the search. And so even had the officer felt the tube in his pocket, which we have zero evidence in the record of, I still don't believe that that justifies them removing and opening the tube. Another point addressed by the state is Maryland v. Pringle as evidence of your question, Justice Crump, as to whether if you find contraband on one person, it can go towards probable cause of another person. In Maryland v. Pringle, the court found in that case that there was evidence of drug dealing and a common enterprise, and no one occupant of the vehicle took responsibility for the contraband that was found in the vehicle, and that was the justification in Maryland v. Pringle for allowing probable cause search of each of the occupants' persons.
And I presume that you're saying because there was an actual opposite kind of situation with the facts related to she said this is mine and he doesn't do drugs and all of that, that you're suggesting that there was no probable cause based on what she had on her.
Yes, ma'am. In our case and in D. Ray, one person was singled out. In Maryland v. Pringle, which the state cites, no one person was singled out. There was evidence of a common enterprise and drug dealing, but nobody, the police officers didn't have any information as to which person was responsible.
I wanted to ask you as well about the standard of review that you're promoting that we apply in this case. So of course, digital and recorded evidence is increasingly available in these types of cases. And it appears that the finding of the trial court in this case was that the officer was going to give the defendant a warning for failure to stop at the stop sign, but not for the driving without a license offense. And did I understand your argument correctly that what you're asking us to do is to view the video ourselves and to interpret what the statement, I'm just going to give you a warning, what offense that applies to. And I guess my question to you is, now, how does what you're proposing impact sort of the traditional division of labor between a trial court and an appellate court? Because traditionally we think of the trial court as being the finder of fact. And of course, now we're more and more faced with this type of evidence. So how are we supposed to balance those competing interests?
Yes, ma'am. And that, I believe, is why there have been so many cases on this issue. And a lot of the cases have dissents that are very, very against what the majority is doing with the de novo review, because they're concerned about exactly that question as to division of labor. And who's really, rather than division of labor, who's in the better position to view the evidence. But what one thing the case law has been resoundingly clear on is that if the record doesn't support it, and again, the standard that we keep seeing over and over again comes from Guzman, especially when there's no credibility determinations. And so appellate courts should be much more reluctant if there are credibility determinations, which to me means the same thing as if there are witnesses in overturning a trial court's fact findings than if there's not. But particularly if there's no witnesses and no credibility determinations and the facts dispute the trial court's fact findings, if the record disputes the trial court's fact findings, the case law is clear that the trial court goes back and reviews the videos, and if there's a dispute, then it's a de novo review.
May I ask, though, is there a case that supports the, is there a de novo review of all of these findings? Because I think I'm hearing you say that you have a particular concern about 36. And so do we review 36 de novo and give deference to the court's findings and conclusions with respect to everything else?
And so 36 is especially important as to the pat down issue. But then there's two other justifications, probable cause and search incident to arrest. As the search incident to arrest, we're asking for a de novo review as to whether the state met their burden that a warning was not being issued and to my client for DWLI. And as to probable cause, I believe there's multiple in my brief, but one of them is sweating. The trial court makes a big deal of the fact that my client was sweating, and the state's brief mentioned it, I think, 13 times or something like that. But then if we look at the body camera, what we see is that the probationary officer who did the pat down said at one point, "Ooh, it's hot, and if it wasn't so humid, then I'd be having fun." And so that's the kind of thing where if a witness is called, those kinds of facts and circumstances come out into the open. We discuss who's sweating and why they're sweating and if there's a good reason and if that's an indication of nervousness. But if we don't have that witness testimony, then I think that's when the appellate court has to come in and look at the record and say, was this justified? Is that a reasonable factor for the trial court to rely upon? And we don't believe that it is.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Troy.
Thank you, Justices.
At this time, we will submit 0323742 CR, Mark Jason Norman versus the State of Texas. Thank y'all very much. Y'all are excused.
Thank you.